let's actually, right now we've got Connor Boyack giving us the Boyack review. Connor, are you on the line?
I am, Jake. How's it going?
It's going super, man. Super. So we're I kind of primed them, but not in the same vein as which you're going to address. But talking about the Constitution today, you had something that you wanted to address with regard to the Constitution and something that's going on in the news, right?
Yeah, and I think actually Doug's call was actually a really good segue into it, just right there at the end where he said that we need to get constitutional people into the government. You know, one would think that of all the institutions, perhaps the ones who are tasked under the Constitution of reviewing the constitutionality of certain laws, namely the United States Supreme Court, would be quote-unquote Constitution people. Now, of course, over the history of the court, we've seen plenty of decisions where that has been proven fallacious. While some justices have been, you know, conservative, I don't think we've really had any libertarian-leaning ones at all, except maybe during the very first, you know, in the founding era. But recently, you know, it's an interesting thing to see what's happening in the news in the past couple of days. This hasn't been too widely reported, though, in blogs and some online media. It's made the rounds. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she is the oldest of the justices on the Supreme Court, and she was recently traveling in Egypt for a little four-day visit to have discussions with judges, law school faculty and students, legal experts, because they're in the process of this transition to a democratic form of government now that they toppled the previous regime. So they're trying to kind of get influences and try and understand maybe what best to include in the proposals for the new constitution. So here is this justice whose job it is and who has sworn an oath to be able to, you know, judge all our laws on the Constitution and uphold that document. And she goes over to Egypt and tells them basically that they shouldn't pay attention to our Constitution at all. And this is an exact quote. She says, "I would not look to the U.S. Constitution if I were drafting a Constitution in the year 2012. She later says, "I can't speak about what Egyptian experience should be because I'm operating under a rather old Constitution." And so she has other quotes where she effectively denigrates the Constitution, saying that it, you know, using a quote from former Senator Bob Bennett, that it's an antiquated document of an agrarian society, you know, that somehow the Constitution that we have, the longest standing Constitution, one which has served as a model for, I think, 160 to 170 countries since our Constitution was ratified, where these other constitutions were modeled either directly or indirectly on the U.S. version of our Constitution, to have a Supreme Court justice go abroad and basically say, "Ah, ours sucks, you know, go ahead and look at some other more recent constitutions," I think is, you know, appalling at best, but very disconcerting to me, at least, to see this person who is tasked with upholding the Constitution to be openly proclaiming her disdain for that document. I found that to be very interesting.
Yeah, certainly a conflict of interest that the person who should be reviewing the constitutionality of things is no friend of the Constitution. Certainly a conflict.
Yeah, she's effectively saying that the Constitution is no longer relevant today, right? That well, you know, we have to stick by it, and I'm constrained by the Constitution to be able to, you know, judge laws. But that allows a very liberal, progressive interpretation to have a foothold, right? Because you're saying that the Constitution is an outdated document, so let's work and try and bend it to be able to make it work today, you know, from the bench, of course, because she's a Supreme Court justice. And, of course, we see stuff like that, especially today with Proposition 8, where in California you've had the California Supreme Court over the past couple of years reading into their state constitution fundamental rights which don't exist. There was no textual grant of power. There's nothing in the Constitution, but these judges, as is commonly said, that they legislate from the bench. They kind of create out of whole cloth these powers and rights that never existed in the document. So what's interesting with Justice Ginsburg is that she suggests a few other constitutions for them to look at. She suggested, for example, the Canadian Charter of Rights, you know, to the South Africa Constitution, for example, as perhaps better models than the U.S. Constitution. So she's not so much interested in upholding ours to the world as has been happening for the past two centuries that so many other countries have modeled theirs. She's instead deflecting elsewhere and suggesting that other countries, and now, of course, these other countries might have, you know, in some instances, better, you know, textual guarantees and you know, protected rights in their own constitutions. That's not to say that ours is perfect by any means, nor that it's really worked to guarantee the rights that it was supposed to. But to have a sitting Supreme Court justice be saying these things, I think most people recognize that it's pretty troubling.
Yeah, I think you raise a good point, a point that we've touched upon in other segments that you've been on, that sometimes the enemies of individual liberty and even enemies of the Constitution use the Constitution against, they're actually using it as a tool against the rule of law and against individual liberty. Come on back, guys. Middle of the Boyack Review on Mental Self Defense Radio, AM 630, K-Talk, the voice of Utah. Welcome back, guys. Mental Self Defense Radio. We are in the middle of the Boyack Review. We've got Connor Boyack on the line. And this has kind of been a Constitution-themed show in general. You know, we had, obviously, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals striking down Prop 8 as unconstitutional, that law in California. But also what Connor's talking about that has gotten a little less play in the media, but is perhaps even more startling, is that what Ruth Bader Ginsburg, one of our Supreme Court justices, is going around saying about the very Constitution that she's there to pass judgment upon. Connor, are you still with us?
I am, and you know, I think you raise a good point. It's really interesting if you observe the trend here of the rising unpopularity of the Constitution, that, as I mentioned on the last part of the segment, that the vast majority of other countries have modeled at least parts, if not their entire constitutions, upon our own. That ours was such a radical, introductory constitution of these things that so many other countries saw fit to then model theirs upon. But it's interesting, in recent decades, as the progressive movement has really become entrenched, the entitlement society has expanded, people have this warped definition of rights, and they want to codify into law, into their own constitutions, that we're supposedly entitled to, you know, a job and to a home. And this was straight out of the USSR constitution, of course. Now, in their own constitution, they had codified textual guarantees that you have the right to, you know, education and comfort and all of these entitlements that they labeled rights incorrectly, of course, because they're not actual rights. But you have this same thing bleeding outward to other countries and now infecting, I think, the United States, where people think that it's antiquated because it does not enshrine these explicit guarantees that people think that we are all entitled to. It's interesting, for example, that Justice Ginsburg recommended, among a couple other documents that Egypt looked into, the Canadian Charter of Rights. You know, you read this thing, and it's quite a lengthy. Some of the rights are very good. You know, it says that we have the Canadians have the fundamental freedom of conscience, of religion, peaceable assembly, association. But you get into it, and they get so granular that you have the right to this, that, and the other. And so you ask the question, well, why does our Constitution not have just this explicit, lengthy list? Now, of course, we have the Bill of Rights. It does have a list of, several rights that individuals have. But then we have the Ninth Constitution. And many people, you know, I'm the director of the Utah Tenth Amendment Center. The Tenth Amendment has kind of gained in popularity in recent years and in attention that it's gotten. But I think we overlook, to our own detriment, the Ninth Amendment that comes right before it, that says, the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. They're basically saying that, look, we're going to put some rights in the Constitution to explicitly affirm that the federal government cannot act contrary to those rights without due process and just cause. But that doesn't mean that, you know, this is like the whole list of rights that you have. You retain all sorts of other rights. The problem here, and I think you'd agree with me, is education, that back then Americans likely better understood what their rights were. They didn't need them to be codified into this lengthy list in their Constitution. They understood that they had certain rights that they had gained as independent people, that their Creator had given to them. And now you find people who are far more ignorant who are saying, well, if it doesn't exist in the Constitution, then we don't have that right. They turn it almost, and very dangerously so, into a government guarantee, a government-granted freedom, rather than an inherent and independent right free of the government. This was actually hotly debated during the introduction and the debate on, and then later the passage of the Ninth Amendment, that the back and forth, the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists said, well, should we include more rights? Should we include less? Do we need to have the Ninth Amendment that says that, you know, you guys have the rest of the rights that aren't explicitly enumerated? And so it was a big factor of decision. So when Justice Ginsburg says, well, you know, these other things are good because they contain more rights and they're more explicit in guaranteeing all these rights, I think she does so ignorantly or in defiance of the collective decision of the framers of the Constitution that recognize that we the people should understand and defend our rights. We don't need them to be codified explicitly, or at least we shouldn't, into the Constitution to feel that we indeed have those other rights that aren't explicitly listed.
Yeah, I think people conveniently forget some of those things. This isn't to say, I mean, both you and I have addressed some of the shortcomings that you can find in the Constitution. But this is really the problem, I think, is that, and I mentioned it earlier, is that we have to walk the talk. The Constitution is awesome. The Bill of Rights, even more so. But if we don't actually live our creed, what is happening now, that is the evisceration of those documents, is a natural conclusion.
Yeah, and we said this in a recent segment, that for me, this ultimately boils down to, you know, quote, we the people, right? You know, the founders considered the Constitution largely simply what they would call a parchment guarantee, that basically we're putting some stuff on paper, but that doesn't really hold any force. You know, George Bush was alleged to have said, for example, at the height of the intervention in Iraq, in the Oval Office, when he was being challenged on the legality of what he was about to do, someone suggested that it was not legal, that the Constitution prohibited what he wanted to do, and the allegation made by, you know, kind of a secondhand story from someone who was there, was that he got very angry and said, you know, don't talk to me about the Constitution, it's just a gosh darn piece of paper, and of course he said the profanity. But, you know, however offensive that may be, and rightly so, I think he's ultimately right that we allowed him to get away with those things. We did not prosecute him for war crimes. We did not impeach him for lying to the American people, to dragging us into a decade-long war that's, you know, draining us of blood and treasure unconstitutionally, immorally, illegitimately. And so he was right. The Constitution is just a piece of paper. It's a parchment guarantee. So as awesome as it is, and as important as it is to both list certain rights and then affirm that we have the rest of the rights that it doesn't, you know, mention in the Constitution, if we're not willing to, and if we're not willing to elect the leaders who will push back and enforce the provisions of the Constitution, to impeach where necessary, to rip out these people out of their positions who are acting contrary to the Constitution, then all it is paper, that we're implicitly justifying people deviating from the Constitution and acting as they please, regardless of whatever supposed constitutional restraints there may be. This ultimately ties back to us. If we're unwilling or unable to do it, I think that the condemnation lies on us, as well as the politicians who are doing it, for not standing up and enforcing the provisions of the Constitution.
Yeah, it's rather troubling, and this is why I like, in particular, some of the ideas of Randy Barnett, that he's written, and that is looking at the Constitution, interpreting it always with the presumption of liberty, instead of trying to figure out and put on your time machine or your telepathic hat and figure out what the Founding Fathers meant, especially in a world where, you know, technologies and whatnot, they didn't have to deal with those issues, but maybe instead that we understand that they were all liberty-minded and wanted liberty for all and equality before the law for all, that we always try to interpret the document that way. I hope that, but to me it seems, again, almost like how the third parties are, that you have the originalists, which are typically the Republican types, and then you have the living documentarians, which are the Democratic types. And I'm hoping that these new ideas can bubble up and prosper, and like you said, through education. I think Ron Paul has really done some tremendous work. He hasn't won. And he's coming in fourth right now, and I would bet that he's not going to get the nomination for the GOP, despite my biggest wishes and hopes that he would. But despite all of that, it doesn't matter, because he may have lost the battles for these nominations, but he's won the educational war.
I think that's so crucial, too, is that as important as it is to be active, to be involved, to try and repeal bad laws, to get good ones passed, we definitely need that educational component. And I want to disagree only slightly with something you said earlier about, yes, we need to presume liberty in the Constitution, but about the difficulty of understanding, you know, what the Constitution says, what was intended. I just finished a great new book that came out a couple weeks ago by a guy named Brian McClanahan, and it's titled The Founding Fathers' Guide to the Constitution. This guy is a very libertarian-leaning, I don't know that he's a fully libertarian, but he's a very libertarian-leaning historian and scholar. And he went through all sorts of source documents and was able to compile a very simple yet very persuasive and effective original intent compilation of the Constitution to basically say, you know, for example, the full faith and credit clause. This was something new for me that I had never read. that often the full faith and credit clause is used to argue that if one state, you know, passes homosexual marriage, for example, that the other states have to recognize that contract that's been done, and therefore, you know, all states have to then, you know, recognize that marriage. It's a very pernicious, I think, legal presumption that what one state does, another state implicitly has to recognize. And he dug up some fascinating quotes from debates and things that give context to what the full faith and credit clause actually means, that it has nothing to do with what modern justices are claiming that it requires, you know, that these states have to recognize one another. It had nothing to do with anything that it's being used for. So I think the educational component is important, but if we're going to be supporting and defending the Constitution, if we're going to be criticizing politicians for deviating from it, if we're going to be encouraging people to support it, we really need to be able to understand the original intent in which it was passed. As Jefferson said, you know, that if we want to understand what the Constitution says, we need to go back to the time when it was debated and ratified and the understanding in which it was passed.
So that's exactly it. They debated it. Mm-hmm. They actually had conversations about it, central to the fact that these are the laws. These are the agreements we're all going to live by.
Yeah, and that perhaps makes it even more troubling that then you have someone like Justice Ginsburg standing up and saying ours is antiquated, because if you read the debates, those are not antiquated ideas. Those were very new ideas. As you know, Ron Paul often says, people say, well, you want to take us back to the 1800s. He's like, no, the ideas of liberty are still comparatively extremely young.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had the opportunity to infuse a government with them in the 1770s, but now we've completely, or I guess 1789, but now we've completely deviated from that over the course of two centuries. The ideas themselves are still very young. They're very animated. This is not something that's antiquated. Yes, it was passed, you know, over 200 years ago, but that by no, what is antiquated is statism, is feudalism, is oppression and tyranny. These things have been throughout the entire world, but to have a government which explicitly codifies, defends, protects liberty, that is something that only rarely has achieved any success, and I think that we need to keep working towards that goal.
Yeah, and the funny thing is, you know, I had mentioned how these originalists tend to be the Republicans and the Democrats tend to be these living documentarians, those that get appointed, but that's who they get appointed by. These judges get appointed by the presidents, and I'm sure, you know, like we've had Elena Kagan appointed, and she's a living documentarian. I'm sure Ruth, you mentioned that she's the oldest justice right now, and when she's it's her time to retire, I'm sure there will be some sort of effort to get her to retire. Maybe if Obama doesn't, you know, his numbers aren't looking so good, that maybe she'll retire before he leaves office. So somebody from the Democratic camp, the living documentarians, can get appointed to hold judgment over this and really to use the Constitution against the people of the United States.
This and you hit the nail on the head. This is why I think the educational component is so important. To the extent that we're allowing these, you know, extremely significant legal decisions of people's rights, of the processes of law, to be determined by a single lawyer. You know, you look at how many split decisions have been decided at the Supreme Court by one justice. You know, these are lawyers. They're predominantly all lawyers. For one lawyer to be able to determine something like Roe v. Wade, I think, might have had only one vote over it. Or even today's vote, you know, Proposition 8, it was a 2-to-1 vote. You know, I think we need people to better understand what their rights are, that they're not clamoring for entitlements from the government, that where their rights are being infringed, rather than relying upon the opinion of one or a couple justices, that they affirm those rights. They don't beg the government. You know, they have a legislature and a governor who stands up on principle and says, we don't care what you say. You violated our rights. You know, you're okay, your lawyers and your courts said that, you know, we don't have those rights, but they're wrong. We do, and we're going to defend them. And this isn't a call for revolution. It's not something that needs to be violent. We simply need people who both understand their rights and are willing to do what's necessary to defend them. And, you know, once it led to revolution, unfortunately, but that was ultimately necessary, hopefully, you know, today and in the future, it can be a very peaceful movement. Like you said earlier, a liberty-minded Gandhi who can lead people in nonviolent civil disobedience and reclaim and affirm their rights. But if we don't have that educational component, it's going to deviate into something like the French Revolution, people clamoring for even more tyranny and more entitlements and more government.
Yeah, and the same thing. It's that same kind of hypocritical nonsense where in calling for liberty and fighting for liberty, you end up breaking all of your own principles, which is not what we want. And, Yeah, I just hope, like you said, that I think peaceful educational means are the best, a market-based method. Hey, Connor, thanks again for such a great segment. We'll catch you next week. Guys, come back tomorrow. We're going to have a special guest in.